these huge giants, you know, walking amidst the clouds or what have you.
Metal music. It's hard to write a song in an entire minor key and talk about, you know, nice things. Heavier, obviously, doomier at times.
When he came over, and God, when he started singing, bloody hell. I couldn't believe what's coming out of his little body.
Somebody said, anyone got an idea what we should do as a stage set? Jesus and Stonehenge. So there's this dwarf who comes out, and he's walking across the top of this Stonehenge.
Pure spell.
Black Shadow!
Welcome to Sabbath Bloody Podcast, the Sabography for the masses. Picking up the pieces here after a sudden breakup, seemingly at the height of what I was calling Neon Sabbath. Our man Dio had had enough of Tony and Geezer's controlling ways, claims that he was going into the studio and remixing their shit. And with a solo contract awaiting him on the other side, Ronnie said, "Peace, guys. I'm out, and I'm taking Vinny with me." Damn, and I was really getting behind that Mob Rules lineup. I do, however, have the reassurance that we will get two more albums from the Mob Rules lineup down the road. So, on and on and on, we march back to an old drummer and a new singer. We got a fucking interesting album to discuss today. One that many of you may have not even given a proper spin if you're locked in that Aussie Dio world. Everything around this album kind of has a surreal feel to it. Strange mix from the cover art to the lineup to the goddamn mix itself. Everyone says that this is the most divisive album in their catalog. You either love it or you hate it. And a majority of reviews that I've actually come across really hate on it, especially ones from when it was actually released. The points against it are always the fact that it's such an abrasive mix to listen to and that Gillan doesn't fit as the new singer. Sure, I can see the mix thing. There was definitely something that got fucked up in the final mixes of the album and it muddied up everything. And yes, it really does kind of kill the power of some of these songs. But that being said, if you've heard as much lo-fi doom and shit like that that I have, you start to be able to see through those production flaws and even intentional abrasive mixes. Like, you're able to look beyond that and kind of see the songs for the cool compositions that they are. So with Born Again, I guess something got fucked up in the mix that they couldn't hit edit undo like you can nowadays. And then some motherfucker just signed off on it, didn't keep the masters, because even the so-called deluxe version of this album, which was released in 2005, 2007, something like that, they still have that shrill guitar tone and the drums are kind of lost in this sea of reverb. It's just baked in there somehow, unfortunately. There were even people saying that the album was sabotaged intentionally, but if you can sneak your head past all that, there's some pure gold on this wax, I'm telling you. So, all in, maybe this podcast will benefit from me not having the clearance to rock the actual tracks for you. And people mostly go after that mix first, and then they go after the presentation of the album. And finally, the Spinal Tap threads that are aplenty throughout the album and tour. But no one really talks about how unique and original this song batch is and how great fucking Ian Gillan sounds on this record. There's nothing stagnant about Born Again, and that's why I love it. And right off the bat here, let's just let Tony fill in the gap a little first here. I'll give you a little reading from Tony's book, as I often do. Setting up Iommi's talent search for the next offering, sans Dio and Vinny. And dipping into the great deep purple slash rainbow pool that he draws from and always finds his singers. I love that these two camps are so intertwined. It's really just one camp at this point, isn't it? Okay, so, well, shit, this would have been interesting, man. Tony writes, "After Ronnie and Vinny left, I called up David Coverdale and Cozy Powell to see if they would be interested in joining us." Coverdale's words were, "Oh, bullocks, I just signed a deal with Geffen Records to do a Whitesnake album." Cozy was with Whitesnake as well, so that was those two taken care of. So look there, we could have had fucking White Sabbath instead of Purple Sabbath. Well, I guess it's Purple Sabbath as well, because Coverdale's a Deep Purple alumni too. Coverdale's deep bluesy voice, that could have brought something really cool to the Sabs for sure. And Cozy is a beast, as we all know, from Rainbow. And he gets in the Sabs anyway later on, or in Headless Cross or in the Tony Martin era. But back to Tony's book here, I'll keep reading. "Me and Geezer had to rethink the whole thing. We had a million tapes sent in from different singers, and most of them were horrible. One of them was from Michael Bolton. I didn't know him at the time. We had Michael come in and we had him sing Heaven and Hell, War Pigs, and Neon Knights. He was quite good, but he wasn't exactly what we were looking for then. We dropped a bullock there, didn't we? Michael Bolton? Bit of a mistake. No, Tony, I think you made the right choice there. I love these audition stories, the whole what could have been moments, just picturing those jam sessions. Must have been a fucking trip. And there are a lot of them with Sabbath, especially in this era. Bolton with the fucking Aussie material. I don't know how that would have come off, but maybe Changes would have worked out better, right? He's into that soft rock kind of deal, right? Anyway, so the search continued. Fortunately, Black Sabbath were still under mob rule at the time. No pun intended. But Don Arden, the Don, was still there trying to make Sabbath the biggest thing in the world, if only to stick it to Ozzy and his estranged daughter. I'm pretty sure that he was behind a lot of the backdoor moves around this time, the real over-the-top gimmicks that arise in 1983. Although the boys kind of say that the infamous first pub meeting night with Gillan was fairly organic, it's also been speculated that Don dangled a huge sum of money in front of Ian ahead of the meeting, so going into it, they were pretty much set on having Gillan front the next Sabbath. Don was really kind of exercising his control on the Sabs for this record. He wanted a product that he could crush Ozzy and Sharon with, teach his brat kid a lesson, and our old friend Ozzy was actually just climbing out of the gutter himself after the tragedy of Randy Rhoads and the plane crash. And then that Sabbath cover band, Speak of the Devil. He now had the great Jakey Lee on board, who I fucking love, and enough buzz around Bark at the Moon that he was flying high again. So Don naturally was kind of butthurt that his daughter was reaping the rewards of that, and he was kind of cut out. All right, let's just get to the meeting. It really was a meeting. So Gillan, Geezer, and Tony met up for an all-night session at the Bear Pub in Oxford, England. Apparently just got fucking legless, and they started saying, yeah, man, we got to be in a band together. Well, let's do it. We're going to be in a band. So the drunken promise stuck, and after the hangover subsided, Gillan was officially on board with working with Geezer and Tony. And like I said, there was probably much more to this transaction than a couple of pints, but they made it official the next morning. The boys were kind of on the fence about still calling it Black Sabbath at this point anyway. Let me read a little section from Mick Wall's fantastic book, which is fastly becoming my new go-to on the subject of Black Sabbath. I just love the way that Wall digs in and captures the kind of darker and humorous sides of the Sabs. So he says, for Don Arden, it was simple. As he later told me, it put them back in the headlines again. This was a great package, something that I could sell in America. So I should probably mention that Mick Wall also does a stellar book on Don Arden called Mr. Big. Really rounds out the straight-up boss that Sharon's papa was. Back to this reading, though. For Geezer Butler, and to a lesser extent, Tony Iommi, it was, on paper at least, a dubious project. We'd finished the Ronnie version of the band, recalled Geezer, and I said to Tony, it's getting a bit of a joke calling it Sabbath, ain't it? And he totally agreed. We just thought it would be interesting to do this thing as a one-off. However, Tony was soon persuaded by Don to play it safe and keep it Black Sabbath. I told them that they could virtually add another zero to the record advance if they did, said Don. Anything else wouldn't have made sense. Geezer was deeply unhappy about the decision. His objections were eventually offset by the windfall in the record company merchandising and promoters' advances that had guaranteed the new Sabbath. Okay, so the Sabbath banner flies on. And like I said, I personally have no problem with them using the name, especially when it's three of the original guys like this will be. Like, not to bury the lead there, but they quickly wrangled our old friend Bill Ward to come back as well. Apparently, Bill wasn't there for these initial sessions and meetings and setup. And even when they were working on the new songs, it was Tony, Geezer, Jeff Nichols, with Jeff's other band's drummer from Quartz, Malcolm Cope. There's a bit more on that in Mick Wall's book here. Like I said, Mick is fucking thorough. He tracked down Malcolm for a chat about his role in writing this album. Another unsung Sabbath session man here. The Craig Gruber of Born Again, Malcolm Cope. I just kept all the drums really simple because I knew Billy was coming in to do the actual recording. By the time Bill arrived back in England, all the songs had been written and demoed. All he had to do was join the dots and add any splashes of his own. Just in case it all went horribly wrong, Coop was retained in the background, officially to help Bill out. In reality, to step in at a moment's notice should he be required. He had some emotional problems at the time, I remember, said Cope tactfully. Yeah, he certainly did. Nibby was actually coming out of his drunken stupor at this time. He had been to AA since the Heaven and Hell sessions and was still in the process of the big come down. when Tony and Geese got in touch with him. As I said, when it comes to the Born Again sessions, Bill didn't attend the initial piss-ups at the Bear. And when he did show up, he apparently had a little support posse with him to keep him on track. And like Brum Buddies do, Tony and Geese were just like, "Ah, Nibby, sure. Yeah, all right, Bob. Get her down here, you cunt." Dangerous grounds for Ward's recovery here, actually, to be back in the Sabs, especially with a drunk-ass Gillen at the helm. And him and Ian seemed to kind of clash on occasion at the Manor, which we'll get into here. By late spring of 1983, the lads held up in Richard Bronson's Manor studio in the Oxfordshire countryside and began proper work on the Born Again LP. So, shit, let's have a pint here ourselves before we get into it. Because, I mean, God knows they did. Here we go. The Manor, another iconic Sabbath haunt for the pilgrimage list here. In 1983, the Manor already had an impressive client list. As I mentioned, it was owned by the Virgin Records dude, and he put up a lot of the big Virgin artists in there, including the big one, Mike Oldfield, for Tubular Bells. If you're a vinyl or 70s horror junkie like myself, you'll already be impressed by that, because that was the theme of The Exorcist, right? The boys get in there in May, and so by this list here that I have, their sessions would have fallen between a Uriah Heep session and In Excess, who record after them. Not a bad slot. Good mojo happening there. Well, they must have taken some time to rebuild the Manor after Sabbath is done, because there's some great stories about those sessions. And of course, they're all here in the Bible, the gospel according to Tony Iommi. Ian said to me, "When we record this, I'm going to stay outside." I said, "Outside? What do you mean?" "Well, I'm going to have a marquee outside of the house, and I'm going to stand there." "Why is that then?" "It would probably be better for my voice." "Okay." I thought he was joking, but when I arrived at the Manor, I saw this marquee outside and thought, "Fucking hell, he's serious." Ian had put up this big, huge tent. It had a cooking area and a bedroom and whatever else. We had all this pyro left over from the tour, so one night, we put it all around the tent, and after Ian had gone to bed, up it went. Boom! The whole thing just flew up in the air, and there he was on the ground, all bewildered, going, "What happened?" The worst of it was, he'd put his tent right next to the lake, and Richard Bronson had all sorts of prized 3-foot-long fish in it. The concussion went all through the lake and killed some of the fish and stunned the rest, so they were all floating on the surface. And I can imagine that didn't do fucking Ian Gillan's ears any favors. So Tony and Ian kind of went back and forth. They're a pair of pranksters that they are. Anyway, they did get a lot of work done too. As mentioned, most of the songs were demoed ahead of time, musically, so it was just kind of connecting the dots for old Nibby. Gillan, he loved to write lyrics on the spot. He's known for being very much in the moment with his lyrics, which we'll go through and dissect here in the show. So let's get into the songs here. And there are a couple of more Manor stories that'll creep into, I'm sure, but by the summer, they'd finished up at the Manor and certainly didn't take much time to properly mix things. I just want to point out, too, for those who can't get past the mix, there is also a demo version out there that you can actually hear things a little cleaner, parts anyway. It's a little less reverbed out. A recording referred to as the Manor tapes, if you want to look it up. It's just bootlegs at this point. They haven't officially released it, but you can find it pretty easily. If you want to search them out, and you should, it helps you to get more of a rounded feel for the songs on the album. And you start to see all the gold that's in here much better, at least in my opinion you do. Apparently those tapes, the Manor tapes, were leaked by one of Nibby's ex-girlfriends at the time when they were working on mixes, so before the final shit production process went on top and muddled everything up. That being said, they're still unmastered, like I said, they're demos, so they're still pretty rough. But compared to the album's mix, well, you can actually kind of pick out a couple of things better. Like Tony's guitar sounds a little better. Ian's vocals, which are actually the only thing on the final mix that work, I think. But you can hear more nuance in his voice. But let's get the fucking bass out of here. And let's talk about the tracks. Because you know what? The power of the riff compels me.
Power of the riff compels me.
Won't you listen?
Thank you.
real fucking chugger to start off, right? Sounds more like a Judas Priest riff than a Sabbath. Sabbath again, though, with the high energy opener here. And lyric wise, this opening track kicks off with another debaucherous manor story. So, actually, back to the text here for a little bit to set up things. More from Tony Iommi's book. While we were up at the manor, we thought that in the long run, it would probably be cheaper to buy our own cars instead of hiring them for our upcoming tour. So we bought 4 new Fords. Bill especially was very pleased with his new wheels. One night, we all went down to the pub, and Ian went home to the manor a little before us. There was a go-kart track that went around the swimming pool, and he decided to take one of the cars out to race it around there. He lost control of it, and bang, the car flipped over upside down. He got out, but the car then caught fire, and he just left it. He got back into the house, threw the keys on the table, and said he was going. And so the car in question there actually turned out to be Bill's. So Bill was really pissed. The only sober guy in his ride was fucking trashed. But he got his revenge by sinking Gillen's boat, one that he would toot up and down the nearby river between recording sessions in. Proper warfare here, these fucking guys, right? Talk about fucking rock stars. Like some next level shit, hanging out at a billionaire's mansion, pounding some top shelf tequila, and then just saying, fuck it. I'm going to rip around the grounds in my fucking drummer's Mustang. Oops, crashed it. Well, might as well write a song about it. We're supposed to be recording an album here, right? So here are the lyrics that Gillen actually penned the next day, inspired by his joyride. It really was a meeting. The bottle took a beating. The ladies of the manor watched me climb into my car. Well, that should be Bill's car, actually. And I was going down the track about 105. They had the stopwatch rolling. I had the headlights blazing. I was really alive, and my mind was blowing. I drank a bottle of tequila, and I felt real good. I had the tape deck roaring. By the 25th lap at the canal turn, I went off exploring. I knew I wouldn't make it. The car just wouldn't make it. I was turning. I was burning. The ground was in my sky. Sorry. It's hard to read these and not launch into the singing. I was laughing. The bitch was trashed, and death was in my eye. I had started pretty good, and I was feeling my way. I had the wheels in motion. There was Peter and the green fly laughing like drains, inebriation. The crowd was roaring. I was at Brand's Hatch in my imagination. But at the canal turn, I hit an oily patch, inebriation. Inebriation. Poor born-again Bill, though. This must have been a real mindfuck on his sobriety. And I really do feel for him in this situation. I mean, I take the piss, but the fact is, he was probably just wanting to be creative again. That's why he met up with the boys. And then he goes in to record with his mates, and they have this fucking lunatic, Mr. Gillen, fucking with him. It couldn't have been that great of a trip for old Nibby. I'm sure the temptation was at a height during these manor sessions. But it all made for an entertaining song, I will say. Not everyone found these lyrics to be a fun romp. Trash actually infamously made the top 15 most wanted list for the PMRC to ban. That's right, Sabbath made the filthy 15, along with some greats like Venom's Possessed, Merciful Fate, Into the Coven, Judas Priest, Eat Me Alive, Twisted Sister, We're Not Gonna Take It, and of course, Wasp, Fuck Like a Beast, to name a few. Being on Tipper Gore's shit list was probably helped the song, really. That's really all that the PMRC achieved in the long run in the 80s. There was a cool new sticker that you could put on your album as a mark of pride, parental advisory. As a youth, I would just seek those out more than avoid them. But I had cool parents, so they didn't really care what I was listening to, as long as it was good. Trashed really grows on you after a few listens, though. Ian's vocals might stick out for those who aren't familiar with his stuff outside of the Smoke on the Water and the Purple Hits. I think it's great, though, especially on Trashed. The bass is cool, too, which I should get into. I have my bass here. It kind of sinks in, for the most part, here with these little rapid-fire riffs that he does. It's fucking great. Right out the gate, actually, Geezer starts on this high octave, like, ripping. Combine that with Jeff's big stabbing keys, and you got a fresh new sound for Sabbath on this album, I think. I put Trashed up there with the 80s Dio openers. It's actually my favorite of all them. Also, be sure to stick around to the end of the episode. Like I said, I have a little treat for you that's related to this track, for those who hang on with me here. Let's see. So after Trashed, Jeff Nichols hits the reset button for a moment. In true Spinal Tap fashion, we get the epic soundscape of Stonehenge. Much like E5150 off Mob Rules, I'm not going to spend much time with this track here. I don't really have anything to play either. They're just kind of transition pieces, really. If I had to venture a guess, I'd say that Stonehenge in particular was Jeff Nichols' one that he would have brought to the table and just dropped it in, pretty much all synth on it. Can't really be critiqued as a full-on Sabbath song, but much like E5150, it's like a great mood setter. And there's an extended version, actually, too, that was a B-side to the single release of Trashed, which is a strange choice for a single. The important thing is that it tees up another barn burner. Check out this riff here. A glorious, maniacal track. I love this. What a fucking wacko riff, right? Doesn't sound like anything Tony's ever played. Disturbing the Priest. The lyrics are equally as fantastic here. This might be my favorite track from the album. Just a fucking hot mess, but in a great way. Good life is contradiction because of crucifixion. If you're ready and have the need, I will take your soul and plant my seed. And the bass, of course, just fucking drives the verses too. While Iommi does those sinister swells on his guitar. Geezer sinks in. Just gotta listen to the dee 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 dee. We're disturbing the priest. I fucking love this track. Another real life manner inspired lyric batch here too, as he wrote the hook after a priest from a nearby church apparently came over to the manor while they were rehearsing and told him to turn down that devil music. It's funny, I've heard people criticize Ian's songwriting style and how it doesn't fit with Sabbath, but people jump on him for being too factual and not mythical or coded enough for Sabbath, like Dio and Geezer were. But fuck that. Gillan pulls it off, I think. He brings a realness and a grittiness even that makes this album so awesome and unique. But I mean, there isn't a lot of fantasy and Dungeons and Dragons in his work, but whatever. I mean, that's not what I look for in Sabbath, personally. I like kind of more real-life grounded stuff. I find Ozzy's stuff is pretty grounded in humanity, too. It's really just Dio that gets into the dragons, and then God knows what Tony Martin sings about, but he builds off a real live event for the title inspiration, Disturbing the Priest. He turns it into a great criticism of organized religion. At least that's what I hear here. The lyrics, this one pairs well with After Forever, I think. So for those who say the lyrics are just dribble on this album, just fuck off. I get that some of it is camp. I mean, there's all this maniacal laughter all over the track too from Gillan. Over the top for sure, but I mean, what's wrong with that? Ozzy was fucking over the top from the first fucking song, right? All his life he's been over the top, like he said himself. I don't know what I'm doing. All I know is I don't want to stop. Shit, no, I need to tune my shit down if I'm gonna fuck with some Blasco shit. Sorry. Shout out to the man Blasco too and all his doom content for promoting Sabbath Bloody Podcast on his socials. Fucking love that guy. Anyway, as I was saying before, Ozzy did just as campy stuff on the debut Sabbath album as Gillan does here. No, no, please God help me. Remember all that great stuff? No one was saying that that was camp. People were too busy shitting their pants listening to that sinister stuff. There's another atmospheric, kind of spooky Halloween music number that follows Priest entitled The Dark, which is pretty much the same as Stonehenge. So not much to talk about, like I said, in the same vein as E5150, but this one might actually be Geezer fucking with the bass. There's some, like, sounds like whales fucking or some shit. Anyway, it sets up our power riff for today. So forget about the dark planet Earth score there. Let's burn this one down. The riff of the day. Yeah, man. More evil shite. This riff just kind of creeps. And the bass carries the song, too. He kind of plays that riff. There's a fucking great overlay that Geezer does, too. These thudding kind of bell notes that punctuate the riffs. Ben has laid them in on his track there. Those little hits. The... Dun, dun.
Power of the riff compels me.
Bill does some weird percussion on this one, too. It's just a fucking great track. Zero the Hero. Love it. I actually kind of remember this one from back in the day. As I said before, I've heard some of the Born Again and Seven Star stuff in the past, just in MP3s that I've kind of collected and come into my feed. And I like this one. This and Trashed got the full 80s music video treatments, too. It's fucking glorious. You got to go check those out. I could do a whole episode on those music videos alone. It's like... If you know the Troma video kind of style, it looks like Troma did these for him. This budget reanimator looking fucking video. But it's great stuff. It's a slower song too, with a bit of length to it, especially if you include the dark as part of it, which I basically do. Although not exceptionally slow, it's got that driving bass line, like we've shown. Yeah. That keeps it moving along some. It's like Iron Man or Children of the Grave even. Songs that are quite repetitive and simple, but the riff is so fucking good and on point that you never tire of it. It's also said that this riff ripped off by Guns N' Roses. They ripped it off for Paradise City, but that's kind of a stretch, right? There's a ninja living under the street. I guess I kind of hear it. Zero is much more heavy and plodding, though, less jangly. Izzy riffing on there. Even though I really love the riffs on here, Ian's role on this song is a little off. I will say, borderline with his sort of rap cadence that comes into his voice, like he's trying for that Mike Patton. Well, shit, this was long before Mike Patton, Faith No More and stuff. But so, hell, maybe he's ahead of his time, but it's kind of like this rappy nu metal kind of. Like, I see what he was going for, but it doesn't quite find the pocket. It sounds a little sloppy Joe. The lyrics on Zero the Hero are well worth diving into here. Let me pull them up briefly. Tell me if you can figure out what Killen's on about here. Accept the fact that you're second rate. It's easy for you. It's all served up on a gold-plated platter. And we don't even have to talk about you. Your face is normal. That's the way you're bred. And that's the way you're going to stay. Your head is firmly nailed to your TV channel. But someone else's finger is on the control panel. What you gonna be, brother? Zero the Hero? Don't you wanna be, brother? Zero the Hero? When you gonna be, brother? Zero the Hero? This sounds to me like a dad trying to get his deadbeat son outside. You're watching too much boob tube, son. Get out and do something with your life. Get a job, sir. Is that what it is? I don't know. Like I said, the music video, too, is super campy. It's like this Igor hunchback dude walking around doing his little Frankenstein creation thing, creating a Revenge of the Nerds looking guy. This is straight Trauma. And he feeds him a shit ton of ketchup. So that doesn't do much to clear up the theme of the song for me. But I do like this last line here. It makes zero sense, but that's the song, man. But the love a duckin' way that you're walking around, sit there with your balls and your head full of nothing. It's easy for you, sucker, but you really need stuffing. Gotta love any song with love a duckin' in the line, right? I'm talking about balls. Zero is a little too long, though. It burns out the A side. Great A side, I might add. But it could use a little shortening. The B side is not as hot as the front. It's kind of a front loaded album. I'll give you that. But the hair metal vibes kind of soaking into things. But it's 83 after all, so it was bound to happen. At least it's not the shite that we get with Black Sabbath featuring Tony Iommi. That's a bury the lead on what I think of that upcoming album, but fuck. Glenn Hughes. The first track on the B-side sets the table for all that shit, actually. Digital Bitch. The title alone is cringeworthy. This is the bad one on the album. It's got to be one, right? And the production flaws really make this almost fucking unlistenable for me. I mean, Tony's solo that comes in, it's like a goddamn ice pick to the head. It's brutal. All I can say is stay away from a digital bitch, okay? The chorus is terrible, too. She's so rich, she's a bitch, doo-doo-doo-ditch. Yeah! Like, I mean, give it up for Ian for busting out the falsettos and stuff, but this song is not worth it, brother. Let's get to the next track, the title track, briefly here. The power ballad. This one's actually okay. Another, still, like I said, this B-side is a little weak, especially at the start. I wouldn't go out of my way to listen to these two tracks, but there's still some outstanding Gillan moments on the Born Again track here. Let's get to it. Born Again! So Ben's got that tone soaked, just like the album. Some 70s kind of phaser tones in this one. Born Again is a big, wet number. So much reverb and chorus and shit, and too much even. It sounds like they're trying to go for the Deep Purple Child in Time vibe, but it's just not working because the drums are completely lost. And even though I love his performance, you can hear a bit of the shortcomings in Gillan's voice at this point, too. I'm just saying, he doesn't quite have the fucking silky Deep Purple croon anymore, you know, on the verses. And that's okay. He still nails the high shit. But that wonderful soft climb that he has on, say, like, When a Blind Man Cries, you can just hear him kind of battling the nodes in his throat on this track. That's all I'm saying. If you follow Gillan, it's no secret that he kind of maxed out around here. The Born Again album and into the Deep Purple reunions is when he really starts to settle down a bit. After Perfect Strangers, of course, he fucking nails that LP too. It's kind of his last breath of the true virtuoso singing in the mid-80s, which is inevitable for any singer. He would have been pushing 40 at the time, so even to be ripping this stuff is pretty impressive. Now, I'm not slagging the man. That's just the reality of things. And he went on to change up his approach a little and adapt his range. And he's even sung with like Pavarotti and shit like that well into his 40s and well into his 50s. And he's still out there just fucking pushing his voice. Just getting pushed a little too hard at this time. He's certainly not playing it safe here. So I'm glad this exists at all and that he didn't fucking burn it out. Lyrics-wise, the title track seems a little off too. This is the second verse, which is just weird, both in content and delivery here. He says, as you look through my window, deep into my room, at your future and freedom, the gray plastic retards all floating in circles, and you taste the fruits of the new sensations, softly brushing your lips as we rise and we challenge and kill. Born Again! It's the chorus that's really the fucking money on this track. Let's see if Gillan says anything about this track on that old website we were checking out, Gillan.com. He does. It's in here. What does he say? He says, it's hard to say what was going through my mind. Sometimes you're trying to express an intangible feeling. Gray plastic retards is probably a dig at the less inspired members of our profession. That would be the business side of things. There's always a need for rhyme, but reason is an altogether more elusive little devil. Overall, it's quite an introverted study about something rising up inside. I get off balance sometimes, and I was on the way to getting centered again. It was good being with Sabbath, and maybe there's a hint of the future in there. The DP reunion was only a year or so ahead. Okay, so cool. He kind of attributes this song to his own making peace with Deep Purple and getting back with them. I can dig that. Anyway, the next track, I didn't really care for this one on first listen, but much like a lot of the high energy power metal kind of Dio tracks, it really was taken to the next level live. And as a result, this has become one of my favorites on the B side. This is Hotline. Take me to the river, baby. Suck my dick. Whatever he says in that scream there, I
I think it's Take Me to the River, Drink My Wine, isn't it? Some Jesus shit. Either way, it's not the lyrics that I dig on this one so much. It's that strutting, that pure Sunset Strip swagger that the boys have on this one. Yeah, it has like a bounce to it. I could totally see this as a Bret Michaels song. Like I said, live, this one fucking kills. They would even open the set with Hotline every once in a while. And at first, I almost kind of wrote this side off after Digital Bitch, which I still don't like. And then that lukewarm feelings about Born Again. Hotline came on, and I think I was just kind of fatigued because of the last few tracks. I was kind of just feeling like this was getting too try hard, rock and roll doctor vibe. But you know what? Putting it, this all in context, like, I don't think a song like this would work with Ozzy or Dio, but Ian just fucking makes it work. Again, the production really hurts this one, so it's not up there with anything from the A side. It's funny because it's almost like they front loaded this album and then did a little better mix on the front part of it. And on the B side, they just stopped caring about the mix. They just left it as the shit that came through or whatever. It's terrible. But Hotline's cool. And it leads into the next number nicely to create a solid two-punch to close this fucking underrated album. So the last track, this one is probably my favorite track from the album. I love this one. And even though it's kind of hair metal too, I guess I'm just on board at this point. I'm on this magical ride. Keep It Warm, Rat. Because Keep It Warm has got the fire. That could have been the power of riff today as well. Great swagger on this song. Like I said, lyric-wise, it's another one that Bret Michaels or Vince Neil could have fucking penned, for sure. But I love Keep It Warm. Actually, you know who else loves this one? Is Nibby. I recall him singing praise for it on his radio show back in the day. And I thought, yeah, this is a great track. Which is funny, since this one and Digital Bitch are the only two tracks that don't have a writing credit for Bill Ward on them, which is interesting. So Keep It Warm is just a Gillan love letter to his woman at home while he's rocking out with the boys. Keep it warm, honey. I'll be home soon, kind of thing. You know the drill. Every fucking rock band has one of these songs in their catalog. I'm not sure why he calls her Rat every fucking chorus, though. But the riff and Ian's delivery of these lyrics make this song a goddamn gem to me. This is kind of like the most Dio that Gillan gets, too, sinking into the power blues growl. I feel like Keep It Warm would fit on the side two of Mob Rules perfectly, and that's why I fucking love it. For some reason, the song just sounds comfortable to me, like they really lock it in here. The whole thing with Born Again is that the songs and structures are interesting, but it's not quite melding the vibes of Gillan and Sabbath together. And with Bill's tracks kind of lost in the mix, it's hard to keep a hold of the serpent's tail, you know? I find that I kind of drift out on occasion while burning this album down as a long play, but Keep It Warm, they just sound like a band that's been together forever on this one, and that's fucking cool. I could listen to this track any day on its own in a playlist, and it just works. Whereas the rest of the songs, like even the great A-side, I kind of just like hearing them in sequence more than anything. Anyway, another perfect closer from Sabbath, building off those great Dio era ones. So outside of Digital Bitch, which is fucking terrible, Born Again is a goddamn solid set of tracks and super interesting on repeated listen, especially if you throw in the bonus track, which I like to do, The Fallen. We'll be right back. Ben riffing it. If they had to swap this one into the digital bitch slot, then I wouldn't have any gripes with the track listing. It's like this Led Zeppelin kind of riff monster here. I really wish this made the cut. It's fucking rad. I'm glad it's on the reissues. And it really would have helped the album, I think, if you kicked off the B-side with The Fallen. There's like a killer drum beat part that rips into it. That would have been so sick. And listen to this riff. It's fucking straight up congratulations song by Zap, right? Yeah, that shit's got some boogie in it. I'd love to see this on the album proper, but oh well. They went with digital bitch, so be it. So those are my takes on the tracks today. Let's get on the road.
Power of the Riff compels me.
All right now.
After the album was completed, thoughts obviously turned to touring and the live shows and how they would present this supergroup and ultimately cash in on it.
It is a funny story. I think those stories are kind of best in the caravan.
All right, so Dawn lines up a proper 96 date world tour. Although this is the Sabs we're talking about, right? So there was bound to be some cancellations along the line here and there. Nibby's quick to create some issues right off the bat. It was at this point, unfortunately, that Bill Ward decides he's going to leave again. Yep. We don't even get him for any live shows in the Born Again cycle. There's been several interviews that he's given where he felt that having been sober during the recording process was a great thing for him, and but he thought the stresses of touring would be a little bit too problematic for his newfound sobriety, so that's why he decided to opt out. I've also heard reports that he relapsed due to the impending stress of the tour and went AWOL during the rehearsals, but only Nibby and the lads know for sure what went down there. But as always, the Sabs train kept a-rolling. They needed someone to play drums on the tour, so enter former ELO drummer and fellow Brummy, Bev Bevan. Not the greatest fit from what I've heard of his playing anyway, I'll be honest. Bev kind of sucks in Sabbath. I mean, both playing-wise and look-wise, if that matters at all. I mean, Bev just kind of has this goofy look. It's like Napoleon Dynamite with a mullet or some shit. But he's a prog guy, and so he just looks like a dork that plays the shit out of his kit, which is what prog guys do. I like my man Ian Pace even, like, maybe my favorite drummer of all time, playing-wise, but goddamn, he does not have it for the rock star look. But you know what? The looks are part of it, man. I'm sorry. Like, Bill Ward has that dirty-ass Bonzo vibe with a big beard. You gotta love that. And Vinny was a little goofy-looking, too, but his playing style made up for that, and he really suited the Neon Sabbath. But Bev is just another level of geeky through and through. His playing kind of lacks a lot of that, I guess, those imperfections, which to me acquaints for to feel, and that's what I dig in a rock drummer. You know, I'm a Bonzo Nibby guy, and I'll take Lars Ulrich over Dave Lombardo any day. Yeah, I said it. I fucking love Lars's drumming. There's all kinds of character in there. Anyway, Bev is not a feel guy, he's a tech dude, but he joins the fold, picks up the songs well enough, I suppose, and they're playing stadiums at this point too, so they weren't going to do that with your man from Quartz that they were fucking around with in the studio, right? I mean, Bev was coming out of one of the biggest stage shows in history, ELO. Actually, that's where the connection must have been made. ELO were Don Arden's big passion project. So again, Don was pulling the strings, swinging dick for sure, to get Bev Bevan coming into the fold. Sneaky, sneaky Don. I'm on to you. Let's go through some dates and set lists now. This turned out to be a pretty extensive tour, actually, albeit a gong show. But so as soon as Born Again was released in August, early August, 1983, the lads started to rehearse for the tour. This was a big stage show. Don Arden spared no expense. They did a week of rehearsals in Birmingham at the NEC. And right from the get-go, you knew this was going to be a fucking shit show. I mean, let's slide over to Mr. Gillan himself here to tell us about these big plans to bring Born Again to the big stage. And let's do it tap style, because this whole ordeal is truly none more Black Sabbath.
Something about this that's so black, it's like, how much more black could this be? And the answer is, None.
Somebody said, anyone got an idea of what we should do as a stage set? Geezer said, Stonehenge. And the guy said, well, how do you envisage this? And he said, life size. So they produced a life-size Stonehenge in carbon fiber and whatever. And three container loads went out with the rest of the equipment. And we could get about a quarter of it on stage. And we're sort of edging between these huge monoliths and whatever. Don Arden was the manager at the time. Don Arden, who I have a very soft spot for. And so we get there, and it's unbelievable. There's all this Stonehenge stuff. So we get to the point where normally, and if anyone's seen Spinal Tap, you'll recognize this, normally three or four roadies used to come on in monk's cowls and the bells would chime, you know, the dong, dong. And then we go into something like War Pigs or Iron Man or whatever the opening thing was. And the last, we noticed the dwarf walking around on the day before the opening show. And what's this dwarf? Oh, never mind, never mind. So on the final production rehearsal in the afternoon, just doing the bits and pieces, this tape came on of a baby screaming. Now, this is the album we did was called Born Again. And the cover was a horrible cover. It was a newborn baby, painted red, with long yellow claws coming out of its fingernails and two little horns coming out of its head. And so there's this dwarf, comes out, and he's walking across the top of this Stonehenge, and there's this tape screaming, and the dwarf's miming at the screaming, and the tape sort of fades away, and the dwarf falls back from about 35 feet in the air and falls onto this big pile of mattresses, right? And then, dong, the bells start, and the monks come out, and then, bong, and the whole thing. It's pure Spinal Tap. So Bev Bevan was playing drums at the time. It was a peculiar year for Sabbath, and we made the best of it. And we're saying to Don, we think this is in the worst possible taste, this dwarf, you know. And Don's going, no, the kids will love it, the kids will love it, you know, it'll be great. Okay. So we're watching from the wings, and this dwarf comes out in a red costume with the yellow fingernails, wah, screaming. I'm looking at the kids, they're going, really, I mean, just everyone was bursting into laughter, you know, it was absolutely horrendous. So anyway, the dwarf came out and fell off, and the scream sort of tailed away, and the monks came out with their cowls, dong, the bells happened. And you could still hear the screaming in the background. It wasn't the tape, it was the dwarf, because we'd taken all the mattresses away, you see. And that was the end of the dwarf. So then came the real problem, because I couldn't get into my brain any of these lyrics. I couldn't understand them. And so the day before we went away, I said to my wife, I said, I cannot soak in these words. There's no storyline, there's no... I can't relate to what they mean. And so I made a cue book. I never use monitors on stage. I've never used monitors. So I made this cue book, and it was one of those display books with plastic pages, and I'd written all the cue lines out, and I practiced in my kitchen before I went away, turning the pages over with my foot. And so I thought, well, that's going to be okay. And I had them put two wedges on the front of the stage. They weren't plugged in, but two monitor wedges to conceal the book. So after the dwarf had fallen without the mattresses and the monks came on and bang, and then all the dry ice started, bang, we're away. And I walk out, bearing in mind that Ronnie Dio was the previous singer. And it's great. The audience is fantastic, going zerk and whatever. And I walk out, and they've got the biggest amount of dry ice I've ever seen. They must have had six buckets up there. And the dry ice is pumping out, and there's floor spots and everything else. And I suddenly... I'm going around giving it all that, you know, shaking the mic stand around and, yeah. And I suddenly went, oh, shit. The dry ice was sort of waist high, and it's swirling towards the front of the stage, and there's my book, and I couldn't remember the first line of the first song. And so I had to fall to my knees, you know, in a sort of, in a dramatic pose, you know, and I'm going, trying to blow the dry ice away. And I'm trying to see what the first line was. And by this time, I'm panicking so much, I don't know what the hell's going on. So I'm going, ah, da, da, da. And all you could see was my head popping up above the dry ice and then down again to see the, the words again. And up again. And I heard somebody in the front shout out, it's Ronnie Dio!
Gillan just sums it all up there with those great stories that pepper throughout this fucking tour. So screw going back to the amazing 75 Sabotage tour with those big awesome set list. This is where I want to go now, the Born Again Tour. It started in August of 1983 in Scandinavia. There was 5 dates in Norway, Finland, and Sweden, and they did a few festivals after that before the typical Europe segue over to North America, which is when that whole Stonehenge set would have appeared. And actually, Reading is the only time where the whole fucking thing went up, because it was massive. So that was an outdoor one, so they could get it up, apparently. August 27th, 1983. There's some fucking fantastic recordings of that show, too. Reading Festival. In the deluxe CD package for Born Again, they have the entire show kind of all mixed and sexy in there, too. It's fucking incredible. Here's your set list for Reading. And this is more or less the set list for the tour. They have the Superzar tape lead-in, which is classic at this point. Then, right out the gate with a great one. Children of the Grave. I love that as an opener. Then it's on to a new one, which if you listen to the FM broadcast of this show, which you should, it's on YouTube, this is the one that they start that broadcast off with, which makes sense, being the new one. The underrated Hotline. Then it's into the classic War Pigs, so already they're doing a back and forth between new and classic material, which is awesome. Then it's Born Again, which plays well live. After that, and I love this about the tour, you get Supernaut, the full fucking song, finally. I mean, unfortunately, they segue that into a Bev Bevan drum solo, which is where I really see, I don't think he fits. You know, instead of the Cuban Breakdown, you get a little fucking lame solo from him. Then it's followed by, oh dear God, no, from Tech X, the Rock and Roll Doctor is in again. I guess that would work with Gillan, actually, but still, why? Anyway, then it's Disturbing the Priest, Keep It Warm, Black Sabbath, The Dark, Zero the Hero, Digital Bitch, Iron Man. So tons of new stuff mixed in there, and it's a big fucking set list, too. I love that. Especially for a festival like Reading, you'd think they'd do a shorter one because they're sharing with so many other bands. But maybe at that point, actually, Reading, they would have just been the headliners for sure. I don't know who else was on this bill. And as far as the set list goes, I think later on they added more Dio-era stuff into the mix. We'll check in on that, actually. But the encore, this would have been something special. You get Smoke on the Water, followed by Paranoid, and Heaven and Hell. So there you go. There's a Dio one for you to close, and a Deep Purple cover, which just shows the respect that they had for Gillan, right? They certainly didn't do any Rainbow tracks when they had Ronnie in the fold, unfortunately. It's also unfortunate that Gillan didn't do a couple more Dio tracks, like Dio Sabbath tracks. I'd personally love to hear him doing Sign of the Southern Cross. That'd be fucking cool. Sub out fucking Rock and Roll Doc for that. Or better yet, Lonely is the Word from fucking Heaven and Hell. That would be killer. Right in his wheelhouse. I actually love how Gillan sings some of the classic Sabbath too, like War Pigs and Black Sabbath even. I like his War Pigs better than Dio's, actually. I know, coming off as a bit of a Gillan fanboy in this episode, but I spent a lot of hours with his voice throughout my life, so he's kind of like one of my comforts, I guess. Ronnie's still kind of very new to me. As I said before, doing this show is the first I've ever listened to his stuff, so Gillan gets a little bit of a boost coming in as far as my favorite frontman. Okay, let's look at some of those other dates. After Reading, they come over here to Dublin, actually, for the Monsters of Rock Ireland. I've heard about this one. It's things of legend in my town here. The bill was Sabbath, Motorhead, and then Twisted Sister, Mama's Boy. I don't know who the fuck that is. And then the Canadian thrash legends, Anvil. Yeah, check out that documentary on Anvil. That's a fucking good watch. Anyway, so once Sabbath's proper tour kicks in, they have some great openers come out with them. For the first European leg, outside of the festivals, of course, they had the new wave of British heavy metal icons. Diamond Head is their opener. And I actually saw Diamond Head at a pub venue recently, just last year. They're still out there grinding it out in the UK and Ireland circuit. You know them. Am I evil? Then for the North American swing, from October up in Canada, down through the States into 1984, either Quiet Riot or Night Ranger that's opening for them. Sometimes Nazareth does a co-headline with them, so yeah, it's the fucking 80s, dude. Those are some of the cooler hair metal acts, actually, of the time. I will say, Quiet Riot fucking rocks. Night Ranger, they all right. Only heard a couple of their songs, really. But yeah, it's pretty much a full year of touring for the lads. And they also brought along Lita Ford for a few dates. And when she had gone solo from the Runaways, supporting her debut album, Out for Blood, you know, when Lita became Lita. Fucking full-on leathers at that point. Very heavy metal-inspired image, which was one that she would maintain well into the decade. I love Lita. I mean, who doesn't? Especially with the Runaways. They're fucking great. Her solo stuff's pretty fucking cheesecake, biker, pen-up-y, but it's fun, and she's a fucking rad guitarist. And this is when her and Tony Iommi must have first hooked up, too. And I don't know if I want to get too deep into that whole relationship. And there's been some claims that things got pretty dark when the drugs and some abuse happened. And I won't get into that here. You can look it up, formulate your own opinions on Tony's personal life. Actually, we'll probably touch on that a bit more during the Seven Star episode, because that's when their relationship and the music kind of intertwine. And you'll see some of the reasons why Miss Ford might hold grudges against a coked-up Tony boy. Back to the Born Again tour, though. The last date of the tour is March 4th, 1984, at the Springfield Civic Center. And so let's see the last set list with Ian Gillan live here, and how it, and if it evolved from the earlier Renning set list that we looked at. Yeah, it did. Right off the bat, after the Superstar tape lead-in, they hit with a classic Dio track, Neon Nights, to open. I gotta find that shit. And then it's back to your typical Born Again set. You get Hotline, War Pigs, then there's a Stonehenge tape playing now, followed by Disturbing the Priest. Awesome. Then Supernaut with the Bev Bevan drum solo, Rock and Roll Doctor. Yeah. That crap. Damn. So a drum solo and Rock and Roll Doctor back to back. That's when I'd hit the jacks, grab a fresh beer. But I'd have to be back just in time to witness Gillan slay Black Sabbath. He's fucking great with that one live, like I said. Then it's another tape playing, this one of The Dark into Zero the Hero. So it's cool that those instrumentals were part of the live experience still. And this would have been a great era to see, man, like, because then it's Heaven and Hell when they split it in two like they did in the Dio era. So they start, they play Heaven and Hell, go into a guitar solo, then they play Iron Man, Children of the Grave, and then when they come back for the encore, which still included Smoke on the Water, which is cool, and Paranoid, when Paranoid's winding down, they go back into the rest of Heaven and Hell to reprise and close the fucking set. So that's a fucking great set list, despite all the fuckery that would have been going on stage with the gimmicks and Ian not knowing the lyrics. I would have loved to witness some of these later shows on the tour live. So when all the smoke settled and the midget had washed the red paint off, a few days later, after the Springfield date, Gillan said, "Adios, amigos." And I don't know if this was always his plan, but only a couple of days after the Born Again tour wrapped, Gillan was back in Deep Purple working on the glorious reunion album, Perfect Strangers, which was released in 1984, so they didn't waste much time there. Sabbath was again singerless. Before I leave you here, though, as always, email me at sabbathbloodypodcast@gmail.com. Give me some feedback on this episode, because I have changed up shit quite a bit. Go back and listen to the old episodes. Tell me if it's working or if you think I should reevaluate everything. And also follow me on Twitter. Let's talk some Born Again. I'll see you next month with a new singer. Actually, a couple of new singers pop up. Like our man Ronnie says, life's a carousel, and so is the vocal slot in Sabbath moving through the 80s. Gets interesting, man. That's for fucking sure. Bog blast all of you.